My name is Bob Chisholm. I'm an Old Testament prof from Dallas Seminary, and I want to thank Concordia Seminary for inviting me to come here. They've asked me to speak about the topic of open theism, about which I've done quite a bit of research, and so I'll be reading this paper entitled Divine Uncertainty and Discovery, Anatomy of an Anthropomorphism. But before we dive into that, my wife says I have a knack for saying the wrong thing at the wrong place and the wrong time, but I just got to ask this question. Is there anyone here other than me that is not of German descent? I have never seen so many German names. Okay. I'm Scottish descent. I like those bagpipes they were playing earlier. Yeah. This is a very esoteric topic, very theoretical and abstract. We'll be interacting with the Hebrew text to some degree. Some of that was done yesterday, so I'm feeling more comfortable about doing that. But before we dive in, I want to give a little illustration as to why I think this is important. When I go to the doctor with a physical problem, I want him to give me some practical advice. I want him to figure out what is wrong with me and prescribe something that will help me heal. I don't want a lecture in biology, chemistry, anatomy, and all of that. But I do want to know that he has been through that and that he has thought about all of those theoretical issues and that he knows what he's talking about. And I think it's the same thing in ministry. People come to us with big problems and big questions, and sometimes we really don't have answers. But our decisions about what God is like and how he operates in the world really do impact our thinking. And there are a lot of different ideas out there. And in one congregation, or parish, I guess I should say, there will be all kinds of ideas that reflect abstract thinking about God. And so I think it's important for us, if we're going to try to help people and guide them spiritually, that we've thought some of these issues through. And open theism has challenged the traditional view of God in a major way, and philosophers, theologians have addressed the issue. I'm going to try to address it from more of an exegetical point of view. So with those preliminary remarks out of the way, let's dive in. I don't normally read to people in my Sunday school class or at the seminary. And if you don't like to be read to, just pretend the paper's not there and pretend that I'm talking to you. But I'm going to read it SBL style. Several passages in the Hebrew Bible depict God as less than omniscient. Many of these pertain to God's knowledge of the future, but some seem to indicate that even his knowledge of present realities is less than exhaustive. For example, in Genesis 18, 20 and 21, the Lord announces the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great and their sin so blatant that I must go down and see if they are as wicked as the outcry suggests. If not, I want to know. By the way, I'm citing there the Net Bible. I happen to be the senior Old Testament editor for that, and so I wanted to put a plug in for it. You can access the Net Bible for free online at bible.org. We think it's a good product. It's no charge, and we have tried to make it available for people in ministry, and so I would encourage you to access it if you haven't done that. Bible.org. Commercial's over. The Lord is aware that a problem exists in the Twin Cities, but before unleashing his judgment, he decides to go down and observe the situation firsthand, in order to know for sure just how bad it is and what degree of judgment, if any, is warranted. In Genesis 22, God tests Abraham's loyalty and then pronounces through his angel, "Now I know that you fear God." The temporal adverb "now" gives the distinct impression that God has discovered information he did not previously know. What is one to make of these texts, which seem to fly in the face of the classical understanding of God's omniscience? Traditionally, most theologians have labeled this presentation of God as anthropomorphic, but some argue these passages are ontological windows into the divine nature that must be taken at face value. For example, commenting on Genesis 22:12, Walter Brueggemann states, "It is not a game with God. God genuinely does not know, and that is settled in verse 12, now I know. There is a real development in the plot. The flow of the narrative accomplishes something in the awareness of God. He did not know, now he knows. Referring to Genesis 18 and 22, as well as other passages, John Goldengay argues that these texts will show that God has extraordinary knowledge, but will incorporate no declaration that Yahweh is omniscient, and preclude that by the way they portray God acting so as to discover things. Goldengay concedes that talk of God acting to find something out is anthropomorphism. But he quickly adds, such anthropomorphisms presumably tell us something true about God's relationship with the world. He adds, in dialogue with Greek thinking, Christian tradition let God's possession of supernatural knowledge turn into God's possession of all knowledge. It thereby let that override the good news of the correlative evidence in Scripture that God does not always know everything and that God finds things out. In this paper, I examine the phenomenon of divine uncertainty and discovery from a literary exegetical perspective and propose a hermeneutical model for understanding these texts. I mean, come on, admit it. This is an odd way for God to speak. Now I know. We're down here to find out if Sodom is as bad as we've heard. If not, we'll know. You wouldn't expect an omniscient God to say these things. My purpose is not to refute, at least in a point-by-point manner, the position taken by Brueggemann and Goldengay, a task that would require much more time, space, energy, and philosophical expertise than I possess. I do propose to offer a more sophisticated defense of the traditional position. I start with the assumption, based on the preponderance of the biblical evidence, that ontologically, God is omniscient in the classical sense. I then argue that Genesis 18:21 and 22:12 do indeed present God anthropomorphically. However, we must not simply label God's self-revelation as anthropomorphic and then smugly move on as if we have solved the problem. Such a simplistic approach dismisses rather than interprets the texts and amounts to nothing more than a lame attempt at sidestepping embarrassing biblical evidence. One must untie, not cut, the interpretive knot. We must address the question, why would an omniscient God reveal himself in a way that seems misleading and inaccurate? A typical answer is that he must do this because we are so limited in our understanding. To accommodate our limitations, God must present himself as being like us, at least to a certain degree, but this explanation is hardly satisfying. The theologians who label these texts as anthropomorphic claim they understand the truth of the matter, that God really does know all things. So it does not appear that our thinking is so limited after all. If we really can and do grasp the truth that God is omniscient, then the anthropomorphic language, rather than facilitating understanding, just seems to complicate matters. We need a better explanation for why God revealed himself to Abraham and the readers of Abraham's story as less than omniscient. I propose that the literary context of each passage provides the key to understanding why God did this. In each case, God's anthropomorphic self-revelation occurs within a metaphorical framework that is inherently relational in nature. God assumes a relational role and then speaks in a way that is consistent with it. In each case, his words, though masking certain aspects of the divine nature, have a specific function to perform that contributes powerfully to his purpose in the world of the story. Through his anthropomorphic self-revelation, God made it clear that his relationship with Abraham was personal and dynamic. The metaphor boldly fleshes out the underlying reality. By revealing himself in this way, God also emphasized the importance of human responsibility. Human decisions would play a formative role in how the future of Abraham and his world would unfold. God really does grant human beings, whom he has made in or as his image, the dignity of causality. His plan for human history accommodates human decisions and actions, as well as his own responses to them. At this point, I don't normally read footnotes, but there's a very good article by Richard Pratt, who surprisingly is a Reformed theologian, and he argues that the Westminster Confession, of all things, not exactly an open theist treatise, 5.2, supports this notion of God accommodating human freedom. It's an interesting article to read, and I would draw your attention to it. Page 3, Scoping Out Sodom, Divine Uncertainty and Discovery in Genesis 18. Before making an attempt to interpret the Lord's statement in Genesis 18:21, we must first examine the immediately preceding context. On this occasion, the Lord visited Abraham at Mamre. He appeared in human form, accompanied by two angels. During the meal, the Lord announced that Sarah would soon have a son. Sarah, who was eavesdropping on the conversation, laughed to herself and thought, "After I am worn out, will I have pleasure? Especially when my husband is old too?" At this point, the Lord, demonstrating supernatural capacity to read another's thoughts, challenged Sarah's lack of faith and affirmed his ability to accomplish the seemingly impossible. Read in isolation, the episode does not prove divine omniscience, but it certainly portrays the Lord as at least having supernatural mental capacities, as if he were omniscient. Furthermore, the statement in verse 13 stands in stark contrast to what the Lord says in verse 21. Juxtaposing the text gives the impression the Lord can read minds, at least of those in the next room, but yet he does not seem fully aware of what has been and is going on down in Sodom. This seems incongruous. I propose that the key to resolving the problem is to take into account the rhetorical nature of speech. We will comment on verse 21 later. But for now, we will consider the statement in verse 13 from the perspective of language function. Peter Mackey observes that language has multiple purposes. He lists seven categories: presentative, expressive, evaluative, performative, dynamic, exploratory, relational. The Lord's question in verse 13 is best taken as both expressive and dynamic. Expressive language verbalizes one's feelings. Sidebar. Expressive language is what you do when you hit yourself on the thumb with a hammer. I don't know what you say, but it's expressing your pain. Even if no one is there, you still say something. Why? You need to express your pain to somebody. So it's expressive. The Lord's question verbalizes his emotional response, disappointment, dismay, outrage to Sarah's cynicism. At the same time, the statement is dynamic. It is intended to impact the hearers in a significant way. As Mackey points out, dynamic language can be affective, pedagogical, or transforming. I suggest that the Lord here reveals the ontological reality of his omniscience because this display of supernatural knowledge serves to enhance his credibility as the one who has promised a child. The rhetorical function of the question is to transform the hearers' attitudes and stimulate their faith. After all, if the Lord can read minds, maybe he really can cause an aging woman to conceive. I will argue below that the Lord masks his omniscience in verse 21 because his rhetorical purpose is different in that situation. Following the meals, the visitors got up to leave. The narrator tells us parenthetically that Abraham was accompanying them with the intention of giving them a proper send-off. Before resuming the story, the narrator supplies more supplemental information. It is difficult to know exactly where the parenthesis ends and the main line of the narrative resumes. It's possible that verses 20 and 21 belong with 17 through 19, but another option is that the parenthesis ends after verse 19 and that the vayik tol form at the beginning of verse 20 resumes the narrative. In this case, verses 17 through 19 may flash back to a time before the Lord's arrival. In either case, the words of verses 20 and 21 must have been spoken in Abraham's hearing, because they reveal the Lord's plan, and Abraham's question in verse 23 makes sense only if he has heard the Lord's statement concerning Sodom and Gomorrah. In verse 21, the Lord's words indicate that he intends to discover information. The verb ra'ah is collocated with interrogative hey on seven other occasions, always meaning see if. In each case, the discovery of information is in view. In its use elsewhere, the first-person prefix verbal form of yada has different shades of meaning, including, among others, know for sure, know more fully, find out, discover, experience, and be aware of. Since the Lord already had some awareness of the situation in the Twin Cities, the nuance know for sure works very well in Genesis 18:21. But this suggests that full knowledge, such as we would expect an omniscient being to possess, was lacking. Why would an omniscient God speak in this fashion? In answering this question, we begin by examining the metaphorical framework in which the Lord speaks and then consider the language function of the statement. The context emphasizes the Lord's role as universal judge. Having heard the Lord speak of his concern about the moral condition of Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham began to negotiate on behalf of the cities, undoubtedly because of his concern for Lot and his family. Appealing to God's justice, he asked rhetorically, "Will not the judge of the whole earth do what is right?" Judges must get the facts straight before they finalize their decisions and mete out punishment. The language of verse 21 reflects this and is associated elsewhere with adjudicating. Several texts associate seeing with judging. While Exodus 3:9 speaks of the people's cry coming before the Lord in conjunction with his seeing the oppression of his people, it seems clear from both the Lord's words and Abraham's response that the Lord assumes a judicial role here and speaks accordingly. We must also consider the issue of language function. It is likely that the Lord's statement in verses 20 and 21 is more than merely presentative. Presentative language is like the evening weather report, you know, straightforward information. The Lord felt obligated to share his intentions with Abraham. This suggests the language is dynamic, designed to impact Abraham in some significant way, and perhaps to prompt him to act. The Lord may have been preparing Abraham emotionally for what he had already determined he would do. The angels informed Lot that the Lord had sent them to destroy the city because the outcry against it was so great. They urged Lot to leave the city, announcing that the Lord was ready to destroy it. They gave no indication that an evaluation was underway. One might assume they had decided to destroy the city before they arrived and that their purpose for coming was simply to warn Lot. However, one need not draw the conclusion that the city's destiny was sealed before the angels arrived. By the time the angels speak, Sodom's guilt had become evident and the need for judgment had been verified by the Sodomites' morally atrocious behavior. The angels had been sent to assess the situation and, if necessary, destroy the city. Having made their assessment, they could speak in retrospect of their mission as one of judgment without necessarily implying this was a foregone conclusion from the outset. If judgment was not a foregone conclusion prior to the angel's arrival, then it is possible the Lord's statement in 18:20-21 was designed to prompt or at least invite Abraham to intercede, just as he did. This would be a precursor to the theme of Abraham as prophetic intercessor, a role that becomes more prominent in Genesis 20, verse 7. At the very least, the Lord's statement, when viewed within the metaphorical framework of God as judge, would have convinced Abraham that the Lord was committed to fairness, which was clearly a concern of the patriarch. But this is not all. The language also makes it clear that the people of the Twin Cities held their own destiny in their hands. God would not arbitrarily destroy them. On the contrary, like any fair and just judge, he responds to the complaint, examines the evidence, and metes out what is deserved. The use of anthropomorphic language, even if it does mask the ontological truth of God's omniscience, more emphatically conveys these truths than theologically accurate language would have done. In this context, apparently the Lord was less concerned with showing off his omniscience than he was with revealing himself as a fair judge, emphasizing the importance of human responsibility and inviting Abraham to participate in the forging of the future. How have others dealt with the anthropomorphic language in this passage? We can only give a representative sampling of opinion, focusing on more recent explanations, including some that have cropped up in the debate over open theism. Michael Karasik articulates the problem in a coherent manner, but his proposed solution, while on the right track, fails to go far enough. He deals with the issue strictly at a literary level, stating, "I think God has to go to Sodom and Gomorrah to see what was happening there in order to give Abraham the opportunity to bargain." That is, God's omniscience was limited by the author of this story for narrative reasons. Certainly, in the world of the story, God's actions and words transcend mere literary imperatives. His statement about giving Abraham the opportunity to bargain hints at the function of the language, but Karasik drops the ball before reaching the goal line. John Frame emphasizes the judicial context of the passage, noting that the idiom of divine discovery often shows up in such contexts. This shows sensitivity to the metaphorical framework of the passage and is a significant step in the right direction. Despite the implications of the text's language, Frame affirms the emphasis is not on God gaining information to complete his own understanding of the situation, but rather on God as prosecutor gathering evidence to present an indictment. This is not evident from the wording of the passage, which clearly says that the Lord must complete his own understanding before he can present an indictment. Perhaps this is why Frame quickly backpedals. Nevertheless, when taken literally, the verse does describe an increase in God's knowledge. At this point, he appeals to the preponderance of the evidence for omniscience before affirming when God appears as a man, he has special reason to describe his knowledge in human terms. But Frame never really articulates what that reason is. He departs from the world of the story and wanders down a philosophical trail, talking about theophany, anticipating the incarnation, and theorizing about the implications of immanence. None of this really clarifies how anthropomorphic language functions in the context of the Lord's encounter with Abraham, who was surely more concerned about Lot's destiny than with God's theophonic incarnation and imminence in time. William Lane Craig provides a more helpful analysis. He observes that the fundamental flaw of the hermeneutic underlying the straightforward reading of the text, and that would be the open theist reading, is its failure to appreciate that the Bible is not a textbook in systematic theology or philosophy of religion, but that it is largely a collection of stories about God's dealings with men. Craig then asked the pertinent question, but what then is the truth communicated by such anthropomorphic portrayals of God? He answers, in general, the truth communicated to us by these passages is that God's sovereignty does not consist of blind decrees operating irrespective of free human responses. Rather, God's decrees take into account and are conditioned by the free acts of creatures. Craig emphasizes the relational dynamic of God's dealings with men and the role of human responsibility. These themes resonate in the world of the story. Abraham is concerned about Lot and challenges God to be fair. He discovers that Sodom is responsible before God, and he assumes a role in the unfolding drama by interceding before God. God's anthropomorphic self-revelation, presented within a metaphorical judicial framework, utilizing legal idiom and functional language, facilitated Abraham's understanding of these truths. Testing Abraham's loyalty, divine uncertainty and discovery in Genesis 22. At the beginning of Abraham's story, the Lord announced his intention to make Abraham into a great nation. The Lord eventually expanded his promise to include permanent possession of the chosen land, as well as innumerable descendants. In response to Abraham's faith, the Lord reaffirmed his promise to give Abraham the land. But ratification of the promise, at least in its expanded form, was contingent upon Abraham proving his loyalty to the Lord. By the time the reader arrives at chapter 22, the promise has not yet been ratified. The Lord is ready to test Abraham's loyalty once and for all. The narrator begins the chapter with a summary statement of what follows. Sometime after these things, God tested Abraham. In light of the angel's declaration in verse 12, the verb nisa, tested, means here tested with a view to verifying Abraham's loyalty. As verse 12 makes clear, the test was designed primarily for God's benefit, not Abraham's. Occasionally, the verb nisa, when used of God testing human beings, refers to a test conducted for the benefit of the one being tested. However, more often, the verb refers to a test conducted for the sake of the one doing the testing. In each case, a subordinate clause, usually employing a cal infinitival form of the verb yada, to know, makes this obvious. And I've listed the text there. No such qualifying clause appears in Genesis 22:1, but the angel's declaration in verse 12, now I know, makes it apparent that the purpose of the test was the acquisition of knowledge necessary to verify the truth. When used of human beings conducting a test, the verb has this nuance as well. The declaration in verse 12, ata yadati ki, now I know that, requires closer examination. It occurs in a handful of other texts. In Exodus 18:11, Jethro, having heard of the Lord's mighty deeds on behalf of Moses and the Israelites, affirms, now I know, or now I'm convinced that the Lord is greater than all gods. In Judges 17:13, Micah, having hired a Levite to serve in his family shrine, states confidently, now I know, for sure, God will make me rich. In 1 Samuel 24:21, Saul, having been spared once more by David, declares, "Now look, I realize that you will in fact be king." In 1 Kings 17:24, the Sidonian widow, having witnessed Elijah resuscitate her son, observes, "Now I know, am convinced that you are a prophet." In Psalm 20, verse 7, the psalmist, probably in response to an oracle of salvation, says, "Now I am sure," literally know, "that the Lord will deliver his chosen king." In each case, the statement comes in response to some type of demonstration of the truth now known, and may be translated, "Now I realize," "Now I know for sure," or "Now I'm convinced." In each case, an advance in knowledge or a confirmation of what was tentatively or less confidently held to be true is in view. What exactly does God claim to discover here? The noun clause after yadati reads literally, "that a fearer of God are you." The expression yirei Elohim, fearer of God, is descriptive. It is composed of a substantival participle in construct with the qualifying divine name, which functions as an objective and specifying genitive. Throw in a little Hebrew syntax there for you this morning. The expression also appears in several other texts. In each case, it describes the character and or lifestyle of honest persons who shun evil. The fear in view is metonymic, referring to a reverence for God that reveals itself in obedience. Before confirming his covenantal promise to Abraham, God needed to know that Abraham was such a person. The test was of such a nature that it would bring this character quality, if present within the patriarch, to the forefront. Returning to the focus of our study, we must ask, but why did God need to conduct a test to reveal Abraham's character? After all, in other texts, some of which appear to be generalizing, individuals affirm that God knows the inner character and thoughts of human beings. Furthermore, God himself says that he knows people's inner character and thoughts. As in Genesis 18, it is necessary to consider the context. As we noted above, the story of Abraham is about God establishing a covenantal relationship with the patriarch. At the beginning of the story, God chooses Abraham to be his covenant partner. The arrangement is comparable to the suzerain-vassal relationship that we see in the ancient Near East. By the end of the story, Abraham has proven his loyalty by obeying God's commands. God has elevated the patriarch to the status of a favored vassal who now possesses a royal grant from the great king himself. God contextualizes his self-revelation to Abraham and to the readers of his story within the relational metaphorical framework of covenant Lord, which is a function of his kingship, perhaps the dominant motif of God's self-revelation in the Old Testament. Consequently, we may expect to see him act and hear him speak in ways that reflect the relational role he has assumed within this metaphorical framework. A closer look at how lords sometimes spoke to their faithful subjects may facilitate our understanding of God's statement in verse 12. As an example, we will consider the relationship between the Hittite king Shupaluliumash, that's a mouthful, isn't it, who was suzerain over the city-state of Ugarit, and his vassal Nicmandu, king of Ugarit. On one occasion, the neighboring kings of Nukash and Mukish rebelled against their Hittite overlord and attempted to force Nicmandu to join their uprising. Shupaluliumash reminded Nicmandu of past relations between himself and Ugarit and urged Nicmandu to be loyal. And the quote is there. Nicmandu appealed for help to the Hittite king and affirmed his loyalty. Shupaluliumash acknowledged Nicmandu's loyalty. Once Shupaluliumash quelled the rebellion, he rewarded Nicmandu with a sizable land grant. He also reaffirmed his relationship with his vassal and officially acknowledged Nicmandu's loyalty. Nicmandu is with my enemies an enemy, and with my friends a friend. To the son, the great king, his lord, he is completely devoted, and he will keep the treaty of friendship with Hadi. So the son, the great king, has seen the loyalty of Nicmandu. In the middle of the 7th century BC, the Assyrian king Ashurbanipal told Sintabni Utsur, the prefect of Ur, that enemies of the prefect had tried to turn the king against him. But he acknowledged the prefect's loyalty and assured him that the king's favor would extend to his children as well. "He and Umanigash have conspired to bring about your death. But since I recognize, literally know, your loyalty, I have granted you increased favor. And the favors which I shall bestow on you shall be granted even unto the grandchildren." Though neither of these texts contains an expression that is identical to what we see in Genesis 22:12, both texts do include official declarations that the suzerain recognizes, the great king has seen, I know, the loyalty of his subject. Within the covenantal framework of God's relationship with Abraham, it is tempting to see the words, now I know that you are a God-fearer, that is, a loyal, obedient subject, as the divine Lord's official declaration to his subject that he has proven his loyalty in the midst of a crisis and is now worthy to be rewarded with a ratified promise. We must also consider the language function of the Lord's statement. The statement is not merely presentative or informative. It is also evaluative. The speaker, God, expresses his judgment on the quality of something, namely Abraham's character, and performative. Mackey explains that performative language designates speech that directly performs some non-linguistic act, such as a judge decreeing, the defendant is acquitted. Promises, invitations, proclamations, covenants, and imperatives all fall into this category because they immediately change the personal, social, or legal situation. While the statement in verse 12 is not technically an oath, it is the prelude to the oath of ratification. And for those familiar with how covenant relationships work, signals the fact that a monumental divine speech act is imminent in response to Abraham's obedient act. So, by way of summary, why does God mask his omniscience and reveal himself as testing his servant and discovering the truth about his servant's character? As we suggested with regard to Genesis 18:21, by revealing himself in this fashion, God emphasized that he was in a dynamic relationship with Abraham, in which the patriarch's actions and responses would play a formative role in how the future unfolded. In short, the Lord granted the dignity of causality to Abraham, his responsible covenantal partner. Once God assumes the role of suzerain, we should not be surprised to see him act and hear him speak accordingly. The evaluative and performative language assured the patriarch that the promise was secure due to his loyalty. The episode, with its picture of a God who evaluates and then rewards, should have reminded the ancient Israelite readers that they too were responsible to obey their covenant Lord, for the promise, though ratified, would not materialize until they followed Abraham's example. The approach taken here is different than the way this passage is usually handled. Typically, interpreters affirm that the passage is anthropomorphic, but there is rarely any analysis of why anthropomorphic language is utilized, how it functions, or what its theological implications might be. When explanations are offered, they often are exegetically unsatisfying and display little, if any, awareness of the influence of historical cultural factors or sensitivity to the function of metaphor and language in the world of the story. As an example, I offer Bruce Ware's interpretation of Genesis 22:12. After making the important point that God is changeable in relationship with his creation, he correctly affirms that God does interact with his people in the experiences of their lives as these unfold in time. He adds, God actually enters into relationship with his people while knowing from eternity all that they will face. But then Ware paraphrases God's statement as follows. In the experience of this action, I, God, am witnessing Abraham demonstrate dramatically and afresh that he fears me, and I find this both pleasing and acceptable in my sight. The problem with Ware's paraphrase is that it does not accurately reflect what the text says. Now does not merely mean presently, as the paraphrase in the experience of this action assumes. It means now as opposed to previously and indicates a change has occurred. I know does not merely mean I see, as the paraphrase I am witnessing assumes. It means I know for sure or I am convinced. Ware gives inadequate attention to contextual factors. I mean, he tested in verse 1 suggests a divine fact-finding mission has taken place. He does not give adequate attention to the implications of the covenantal metaphorical framework or the function of the language. Ware concludes, through Abraham's action of faith and fear of God, God sees and enters into the experience of this action of obedience, which action in heart of faith he has previously known fully and perfectly. What this kind of interpretation offers is a way to understand the text as communicating a present and experiential reality that is true of God at the moment of Abraham's act of faith, while it also safeguards what Scripture elsewhere demands, the previous full and perfect knowledge God had of Abraham's fear of him. God's statement, as interpreted by Ware, simply reflects what God is experiencing at this point in time. However, as we have tried to show, the language of the text suggests God has learned something. Rather than dealing with the nuances of language function, Ware wants to take the statement as simply presentative or informative. He seems more concerned with making the language safe for orthodoxy than he is with wrestling with the purpose and implications of such bold anthropomorphic self-revelation. His recognition that God is relational is insightful and important, but he does not probe far enough into the nature of that relational dimension and what God's anthropomorphic self-revelation tells us about it. Summary and implications for the open theism debate. In this study of two key texts in Genesis, I have argued as follows. One must recognize that God acts and speaks in each text within a metaphorical framework. In Genesis 18, he reveals himself as royal judge, while in Genesis 22, as throughout the Abraham story, he is the patriarch's covenant Lord. It should not be surprising that God, having contextualized his self-revelation within a metaphorical framework, acts and speaks in ways that are consistent with the role he has assumed. Two, in evaluating what God says, one must not assume the statements are simply informative. The language is functional in the world of the story, meaning it is accommodated to the metaphorical framework. In the case of Genesis 18, God's words are dynamic. In Genesis 22, they are evaluative and performative. When language serves a function beyond being informative, the truth of divine omniscience can be masked. Three, when God's anthropomorphic self-revelation is evaluated in the literary context and in the world of the story, it becomes apparent that it highlights the relational dynamic between God and his servant, as well as the importance of human responsibility. Through anthropomorphic self-revelation, God makes himself a player in the unfolding drama, but he also makes it clear that Abraham has an important role to play. These conclusions have implications for the open theism debate. Unlike Brueggemann and Goldengay, open theists affirm God's knowledge of the present is exhaustive. As for the future, he knows what can be known, but this does not include the free actions of free beings because, open theists argue, these do not become part of a knowable reality until they actually materialize in space and time. Open theists sometimes appeal to Genesis 22:12 in support of their position. But as their critics have been quick to point out, this text, like Genesis 18:21, pertains to God's present, not future, knowledge. I assume that open theists explain the language of uncertainty and discovery in Genesis 18 as anthropomorphic. But the same hermeneutical model one utilizes to explain how anthropomorphism works in Genesis 18 can be applied to texts that seemingly limit God's knowledge of the future. As in Genesis 18 and 22, whenever God's knowledge, whether of the present or future, seems to be limited, God's self-revelation can be seen as contextualized within a metaphorical framework that utilizes functional language to highlight the relational dimension of God's interaction with the world and the importance of human responsibility in the outworking of his plan. As an example, consider the statements of divine expectation in Jeremiah 3. Here the Lord states that he expected Israel to return to him, recognize his authority, and be faithful to him. But Israel persisted in idolatry. On the surface, the text seems to indicate that God was surprised at Israel's response, which was the opposite of what he anticipated. This seemingly implies that he did not know for sure how Israel would act. However, one must consider the metaphorical framework for the statements, as well as their language function. In Jeremiah 2 through 5, the Lord compares his covenantal relationship with Israel to marriage. Like a new bride, Israel once loved him and followed him, but then she became unfaithful and committed adultery with other gods. Within this metaphorical framework, the Lord assumes the role of and speaks as a husband who has been rejected by the one whom he loves. In 3:19, the metaphor even gets mixed as the Lord compares his relationship with Israel to that of a father and son. These familial metaphors become powerful vehicles by which God expresses his intense emotional response to wayward Israel. With regard to 3:19 and 20, Terence Fredheim writes, "What intimacy God desired in his relationship with the people, and what disappointment is expressed here." While literary purists might deplore the mixing of the paternal and marital metaphors here, the effect is almost overwhelming in its pathos. God has been rejected both as parent and as husband. Within this familial framework, one expects to find very emotive language that extends beyond the simple informative level. This framework provides the context in which the statements of God's unrealized expectations should be evaluated. When viewed in isolation, the statements are expressive of the hope and desire a loving God has for a vibrant relationship with his people. The statements reflect what one would naturally expect a longing, hopeful husband or parent to say in such circumstances, as well as what he has every right to expect from his wife or child. One could paraphrase the statements as follows: even after she was unfaithful, I still expected her to come back to me. I treated her as if she were my son. After all I did for her, I naturally expected her to follow me. But the language is more than expressive. In their present context, these statements are part of God's accusation against his people. As the backdrop for the accusations, the statements of divine expectation highlight what was expected and should have happened. God has been violated, his anger is justified, and he has every right to threaten Israel with judgment. The statements of divine expectation prove to be dynamic in function. In addition to expressing God's love for his people, they highlight the magnitude of their offense and the justice of God's case against them. But this is not all. God is not simply decreeing judgment here. On the contrary, his intention is redemptive, as the repeated calls for wayward Israel to return to him make clear. When juxtaposed with the calls to repentance, the statements of divine expectation also remind the people of God's continuing commitment to them, and as such have a motivating function. It is simplistic and misleading to wrest such emotive, functional language from its metaphorical framework and literary context, read it as simply informative, and conclude that God's knowledge of the future free actions of his creatures is somehow limited. A final appeal. In conclusion, I would like to issue a word of caution to interpreters, especially theologians and philosophers. In dealing with the Bible, one should recognize the literary, contextualized nature of texts that describe God's relationship with his people. One should not assume that God's acts and words, when viewed or heard at the surface level, are ontological windows to the divine nature. One should probe deeper, considering the metaphorical framework in which God acts and speaks, as well as the function of his words. As this study has attempted to show, these texts do prove to be ontological windows that allow us to see the divine nature. But what we actually see is different than what may seem to be the case on the surface. These texts we have considered are not proof texts that God's knowledge is limited, but neither should they be dismissed as mere anthropomorphisms. On the contrary, they testify loudly and clearly that God desires to relate in meaningful ways to those whom he has granted the dignity of causality. To this end, his actions and words, though they may at times mask certain aspects of his nature, such as his omniscience, always express the truths he wants his people to understand in a given time and place, and reveal him as he wants to be seen by them. And just a final note here, I'm emphasizing God's desire to have a relationship with people. I think the classic Old Testament passage in this regard is God mud wrestling with Jacob. I mean, God stooped to do that. And then, of course, the ultimate example is the incarnation. God desires to have a relationship with us. And what we do in that relationship matters. And he invites us to participate with him in the forging of his plan. Thank you for your kind attention. And I guess we've got some time for questions, comments, whatever. Yes, brother.
Would you speak to the cry of dereliction from the cross, where on the surface it appears that Jesus is surprised? I've heard it said that perhaps he said that for us, but that seems like play acting.
I mean, let's go back to Gethsemane. I mean, he actually prays, if there's any way possible, may this cup pass from me. But then he submits to God's will and says, but, you know, thy will be done. You know, I see Jesus, the real human side of Jesus there, and he is struggling with what lies before him. Even though Hebrews says, for the joy set before him. Isn't that interesting? For the joy set before him, he looked forward to the cross. I don't see a whole lot of joy in Gethsemane or on the cross. And I think that's significant. I don't know if I've answered your question. Those are just some thoughts. I'm not a theologian, so I can bail out. Yes, David.
Thank you very much for your paper. The open theists often will say that people supporting classical theism owe us an explanation of what these anthropomorphisms are supposed to communicate, and I think you've very clearly provided that for us with these texts, so thank you very much.
Thanks.
I'd like to try another New Testament application, if I may.
Okay.
And that's the just to get your comments on this, and that's the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25. I was intrigued by your language of an official declaration when it comes to the angel saying, "Now I know that you fear God." And especially that passage in Genesis is linked to justification in James, as James sees that as the point where Abraham is justified, whereas Paul sees Abraham's justification occurring when he fears God in Genesis 15.
I think maybe I'd try to harmonize Paul and James.
Well, I
a
do too.
More.
I'm not trying. But what I'm wondering is if I guess the question that comes up in Matthew 25 is why is Jesus citing works if we're saved by being justified? And I'm wondering if your notion of an official declaration could help there. That what's actually going on in 25 is. It doesn't deny that the sheep were justified before mm-hmm. and that's why they're going to heaven, but it's rather like in the angel saying, "Now I know that you fear God," that's an official declaration of what God has done. And that would be a way of harmonizing Paul and James.
Uh-huh. I like what you say there. I'm not prepared to talk about the implications of what I'm saying here with regard to that passage, but it sounds as if you may be on the right track. I think we need to take into account metaphorical framework, language function in any text that we're dealing with. And so I'd be interested in seeing how you would develop that further. I think I'll just settle with that. I think getting back to your question, brother, I don't feel like I fully I'd call that expressive language. You know, I think that Jesus is expressing his pain. And, you know, maybe it may be more than that. Sometimes these language functions can work concurrently. They're not limited to that. But I think it's important to, you know, always consider language function. When I come home and my wife has had a long day and she says, "Oh, I need to tell you what happened to me today." And as she starts to tell me what happened and all of the trials she may have gone through, and I start giving answers, that's no good. That doesn't go over. She is not telling me these things so that I can provide answers. She is expressing the frustration, and she needs a different response. And I just think it's important to always consider, how is language functioning? And there's a lot of theoretical work on this, but a lot of it's just common sense. If we just think about how we speak in context and relationships on an everyday basis. Dr. Robbie.
Well, thank you very much for your paper, and I very much appreciate you're stressing the importance of the metaphorical framework and the function of language. And so what I wanted to do was maybe offer an additional way to go with that Genesis 2 passage. You emphasize, you know, the covenant as the mm-hmm. framework. God enters into this role, and then the role has certain conventions that are associated with it. And it seems to me that in that Genesis 2, it might be worthwhile exploring the conventions associated with testing. In other words, that God is going to test his chosen Abraham in order to be fully sure that Abraham fears God even more than his love for Isaac, and that entering that role of testing means that the test actually has to happen. See, mm-hmm. In other words, it's not enough then to say God knows his heart, because he's carrying out a test. And so, and then the whole point of the test is, you know, like you said, to be fully sure, you know, as the tester. And I'm wondering how that might kind of fit into the metaphorical framework that you set up.
Well, thanks. Thanks for that observation. Yeah, I see the testing as inherent in the covenantal relationship. the suzerain chooses a vassal, and you know there are certain obligations that the vassal has, and this is, you know, there are examples throughout the Bible where you pass the test and that ratifies the covenant. So I agree, there has to be a test in a covenantal kind of relationship. That's just the way it works in the culture and often in the Bible. But yeah, I like what you're saying. We're both Hebrew teachers. And you know, I think sometimes after 2-3 weeks, you can almost predict. I mean, you could do a over-under kind of betting line. I mean, you can almost predict that student A is going to get this grade, student B is going to get this grade. But if you just say to the students, hey, I've decided that you're a C student, they're going to object. So we actually give tests. But I think very often we could almost predict and know ahead of time how those tests are going to fall out. Because you got to be careful with subjective tests, because you don't label students a certain way and then you always give them the grade that you think this is a C student, he's always going to get a C. But a very objective testing, like with Hebrew, you can do this. And so, I think that's consistent with what I'm saying about the covenantal model and fits right in nicely. And thanks, I appreciate that observation. Yes, Richard.
I'd like to ask Dr. Gibbs to respond to that. My God, why have you forsaken me, if he's willing, after you finish this.
I'd love to
comment.
Hear what he has to say.
Well, he might. He's been responding, so he might be able to do that.
Okay,
but
great.
If he wants to. But until I finish with this other part, we'll let him talk after us. On page 11, you mentioned that the last part of that first paragraph, the episode with its picture of God who evaluates and then rewards should have reminded the ancient Israelite readers that they too were responsible to obey their covenant Lord, for the promise, though ratified, would not materialize until they followed Abraham's example. Okay, there's the conditional covenants and the unconditional covenants. I'm thinking that the one with Abraham was unconditional, and now this is implying that, well, Abraham, if you've passed the test, then we'll follow through on it.
Great question.
Your comment.
The way I explain this is I would affirm with you that the Abrahamic covenant is unconditional. When we affirm that, however, we are really affirming it in retrospect. We're looking back on the story and how the story ends. But in the world of the story, I don't think in Genesis 12 it's unconditional at that point. And we have a debate about this I'm a dispensationalist, within our own dispensational circles. Ryrie says one thing, Walford says another, and some others say this. So we argue about this within our own circles. I'm just not convinced that Genesis 12, at that point in the story, it's a unconditional covenant. Abraham is going to be tested. I think the real difficult passage is in 15, because the Lord, in response to Abraham's faith, seems to do something there along the lines of ratification, but a lot of that depends on how you take the symbolism. One of my colleagues, Gordon Johnston, has been doing a lot of research in the ancient Near East in terms of the background of that symbolism, and he is not convinced that the covenant is ratified at that point. But I think by the time you get to chapter 22, it is ratified. At that point, the covenant is unconditional. But Bruce Waalke, whose name came up earlier today in another context, has written an article, and I can't remember all of the bibliographical data, on the phenomenon of conditionality within unconditional covenants. And he points out that even though a covenant may become unconditional, timing is still conditional. So that's what I'm getting at here. I think that passage in Genesis 18, the Lord makes it clear that the promise, it's almost as if he anticipates the promises being ratified, but he makes it clear that Israel will not experience the reality of those promises until they follow Abraham's example and become sons of Abraham, as it were, spiritually, not just physically. I agree with you. I see the covenant as unconditional, but not until Genesis 22, maybe 15. It might come in two installments. 15, the basic form of the covenant is ratified, and then 22, the expanded form of the covenant is ratified. But from Genesis 22 on, if you read the later accounts where it's given to the patriarchs, they don't have to do anything. They receive it because Abraham kept my laws and my commandments. I think Genesis 26, 3-5. And that's the way it's viewed. But there still is the issue, and I see this as one of the great tensions in Old Testament theology. How is Israel going to actually experience the benefits of God's promise? I think the Mosaic Law was an opportunity for them to demonstrate that they were worthy, and they failed miserably, of course. And I think the New Covenant becomes the solution, but we may differ on all the ins and outs of that. I think the new covenant is God's solution to that problem of the conditionality in terms of the ultimate realization.
I am not Dr.
My brother
Gibbs.
From Dallas. Yeah.
It is good to be here with you and to have you among us. Thank you for crossing the Red River northward.
You're welcome.
Last June, I was blessed to travel to Israel and Jordan. It is one thing to go to Bethlehem and ponder the incarnation. It is another to go to the Jabbok and see the mud and to know that somewhere along this current and flow, Jacob wrestled with and was wrestled by God. Help me, brother, and teach me. There seems to be, in my mind, an anticipation of the incarnation in the anthropomorphic texts. And while we are so freighted with our Lord taking on flesh in the Virgin's womb, we might the better amble toward that, seeing the mud on Jacob, and hearing that God deigned to get into the mud in the river with Jacob. That is perhaps a predictor that God would deign through Mary and the Spirit's conception, cause of that conception, would come among us. It is a great mystery to me that God would enter flesh. It is also a great mystery to me that God deigns to enter language. And if we struggle with the concept of his infleshness, we also ought to wrestle with the in-languageness of God. And after I spin a few words there, ultimately I want to go off to the mystery that God is God and he loves me in Christ. And I want to see the mud on Jacob, that he is with us in this time and in this place, and that we are comforted ultimately by the struggle of the cross and the empty tomb. Can you help me connect with the literature? And I'm not familiar with it, a lowly parish pastor from south of the Red. Can you help us with the ways in which some have touched on incarnation prediction coming from the anthropomorphic text of the Old Testament?
I'm just a humble exegete. I'm not up on all the literature, but I would like to comment on what you said. I think sometimes we view the incarnation